Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight into how it affects our national deterrence. We hope you enjoy this show.
Hey, welcome to another exciting edition of the NIDS View. I am Curtis McGiffin, your host today. I am not Adam Lowther. Adam and Jim are on assignment. They are down in Shreveport, Louisiana for the Triad Symposium, where they are part of the hosting party is and participating with Peter Husey and company as they spread the deterrence cheer to the Air Force Global Strike Command network down there in Northwestern Louisiana. So we're excited here today as we're recording. It is the Juneteenth holiday. So happy Juneteenth. And so I'm joined today by Kirk Fancher. He is a senior fellow here with NIDS. He is a retired Air Force colonel and a bomber pilot, and was one of what we call a plank holder in the headquarters Air Force A-10, which is the Strategic Deterrence and Nuclear Integration Directorate for the Chief of Staff of the Air Force. Basically, they're the guys that push all the deterrence policy within the Air Force. That's where Kirk and I met and worked together back in the day. And so, Kirk, glad to have you here. Welcome.
Thanks, Curtis. Thanks for the invite.
Yeah, I'm happy to have you here.
Good to not be in Shreveport.
This is my favorite time of year in Shreveport. Well, I'll be down there in July, so I'll get my taste of it as the summer rolls on. Well, because it's just me and Kirk today, you know, everybody's on holiday or off doing work on assignment, as we like to say, we're going to do things just a little bit different. June has been an active month in a lot of interesting things that are national security related and indeed deterrence related. And so what I thought we would do is I picked out four subjects that I'm hoping we can get through today. And so we'll just kind of work through these as much as we can. And basically, I'm going to sort of throw these things out here. I'm going to get Kirk's thoughts on it, and we'll exchange some ideas, and then we'll move on. And hopefully you, the listener, will find some of this interesting as perhaps we observe and pontificate on what we're seeing out there as these events go on. So the first thing we'll talk about today is a recent announcement by the Swedish think tank SIPRI, which is the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, which is a nuclear disarmament organization, of course, in Sweden, our newest NATO member, that is that does these annual reports, and they're sort of evaluating the world's nuclear progress towards disarmament. And unfortunately, for the last few years, and specifically this year, for them, the news hasn't been very good because there's not a lot of disarming going on. And so this report came out, and there was there's been some articles sort of touting the success of this. Of this report, if you will. The big highlight here is that it's basically an assessment of 2023, was that spending across the globe in nuclear weapons, nuclear-associated, I call deterrence, but nuclear weaponry, is up $10 billion over 2022. And that, of course, is bothersome or troublesome to these folks. And so they point out that the total numbers of nuclear weapons have actually increased by 60. That was the estimate basically from largely from the Chinese growth. But there have been other growth discussed in the article, which we may talk about here in a few minutes, from other nations. Interesting enough, none of the growth is attributed to the United States. So there we go. And of the $10.7 billion increase in 23, they still blame the United States for about 80% of that increase, of which The total share is about $51 billion. So in total, the world, Kirk, spent $91 billion on their nuclear arsenals in 2023. And as a glass half full kind of guy, not what Jim normally accuses me of being, I would argue for that. That's less than, well, maybe just slightly more than, I should say, 10% of the entire DOD budget for the United States spent globally to prevent the next conventional world war. I think that's money well spent. What do you think, Kirk?
Well, I think it's not surprising. I mean, it's also not surprising that, you know, it came as a surprise to the disarmament community. You know, we have gone through a period of disarmament, but you know, of course, one of the pillars of the New START was that that came along with a bill for modernization and keeping what we have on the shelf safe and reliable. And I think, you know, that trend is a global one. Perhaps the most alarming part to me is that it seems like everybody in the world, including the Indians and the Pakistanis and the Israelis, are upgrading and modernizing at a rate that far exceeds what, you know, the United States is doing. And of course, it's hard to say with, you know, us planning to spend $1 trillion over the next 30 years that we're neglecting the arsenal at this point in time. But we're also making up for some lost ground because these other nations have been. I mean, India just now has a MIRV, and you know, can reach pretty much every place in China. The Chinese, of course, are doing a lot of things. What is it? The North Koreans just launched a small missile from a silo type infrastructure. And then you can't dismiss the submarine-based upgrades to hypersonic nuclear-tipped missiles, and even the Poseidon underwater nuclear-powered nuclear torpedo. You know, as things that other people around the world who maybe don't have as peaceful a view on things as the people of the United States do, are spending their money on. I mean, they're nuclear hypersonic missiles off of Russian attack boats, and we're talking about killing Slicka men.
Well, I'll say, and you're absolutely right, Kirk. It's really interesting what's going on here. In 23, we know that the U.S. government already announced in the late fall of 23, in the annual report to Congress on Chinese military affairs, that China had already believed to have 500 warheads. And so CPRI is just now saying it's been an increase from 410, their previous number, to 500. So they're telling us news that's already 7-8 months old in this newly printed report.
I think the bigger news there, and yeah, it's not something that CPRI really discussed. It was in some of the other things that you and I have been talking about and reading, is we now believe that the Chinese have ICBMs on nuclear alert day to day.
That's right. That's right. That's right.
At a time when, you know, the Brits are concerned that they may have to go to only having a submarine at sea part of the time, that there might, yeah, be scheduled periods where they don't have their continuous deterrent because of their problems with you know, their submarine build. They're suffering from. It seems like everybody has a submarine industrial base problem except for China and Russia.
Go figure. So yeah, it is.
Not that I want to get on a Russian or a Chinese submarine. so there may be a quality versus quantity argument there, but they're certainly able to focus their national efforts towards nuclear weapons. And you know, that's a focus that governments around the world have. I mean, there was a great conversation in the UK about, you know, their boomers being behind and overcost, and the argument wasn't that, you know, that the conservatives didn't do their job. The argument was that, well, labor's got to continue to, you know, has got to make it better. Labor's not backing away from the fact that they have to make this work, and they're going to have to spend a lot of money on their boats. So even within the UK, you've got bipartisan agreement that they've got to do something about their deterrent.
Well, that's the rub. You know, when you let things get too bad, if you will, it's really hard to catch up. Much easier to sort of keep up with the pace. Before we leave this topic, SIPRI notes that they believe that the Russians have deployed 36 more warheads. The Chinese deployed a number of more warheads. The Pakistanis, a few more warheads, so forth. And, of course, North Korea is likely got enough fissile material for a total of 90 warheads. The big thing to note here, Kirk, that they don't say, there's no note, you know, asterisk symbol somewhere on this report. They really don't know any of this stuff, right? No one is self-reporting these things, certainly not the adversaries or the autocracies. And they're not going to tell the world what they really have or what they necessarily intend to do. So it is something to always take with a grain of salt when we read these reports and reviews, which are all written by the same individuals, almost verbatim here with Hans Christensen and his team. So so if you're interested in learning more, SIPRI report came out around the 17th of June. Go ahead.
But the other thing that was really interesting before we go about that is they made no reference to the START Treaty and yes. Measuring progress against that. Right. Or, you know, so that leaves two important topics uncovered. You know, are the Russians continuing to comply with New START, or have they just abandoned it? And we not only unilaterally disarmed, but we're unilaterally participating. And the other piece is, the distribution between non-strategic and strategic weapons in the Russian arsenal, which is sort of a segue into what's going on with Putin and the Ukraine.
Yeah. Well, just to wrap things up here on this one as we can move on, is that it's important to understand that we really don't know because we haven't had any real verification. Before all you listeners send me nasty emails about, hey, we've got plenty of national technical means to sort of cross-check some of these things. If that were enough, we wouldn't have written in-person verification rules into the treaty. So I would say that we're still stabbing in the dark as to what goes on beyond the eyes of our satellites. So, Kirk, so the next thing that sort of piggybacks on this is also on the 17th of June, the NATO chief secretary general there, Jens Stoltenberg, made a note that that it's time maybe in NATO to start putting nuclear weapons on what he calls standby. This report was made that NATO is in talks to deploy more nuclear weapons, taking them out of storage and placing them on standby in the face of a growing threat from Russia and China. Didn't know it. NATO was suffering a threat from China, so that's interesting. I'm not sure what standby means. Does that mean putting them on, you know, alert? Are they going to have loaded dual capable aircraft ready to rock and roll? What does that mean, and how does that change things as we look at NATO and the dynamic of Russia and Ukraine?
Well, I think two things. First, I think you hit an important point. What does standby mean? And I think it's probably more political posturing than anything. Than posturing nuclear forces. You know, they're not going from posture 7 to posture 5. It has an interesting tie-in with, again, the Brits are having trouble keeping boats at sea. The French are talking about a more robust contribution to extended deterrence for the rest of NATO. The Poles are talking about wanting to participate in burden sharing. The Germans were talking about wanting nukes not to be in Germany and not to participate in burden sharing with dual capable aircraft. They seem to have done an about face on that. So you know, I think, especially as the F-35 becomes more ubiquitous within NATO, you know, part of the question is maybe standby is something along the lines of training more crews.
more exercises, more readiness.
More exercises, more readiness. And then, you know, we don't talk about basing, you know, where warheads are stored versus where aircraft are based. That's a topic we just don't discuss. So, right. You know, maybe NATO is thinking something along those lines of, you know, going back to the 50s when all of our nukes were held by the Department of Energy.
And, that's right.
You know, they had to put them on a truck and send them to Barksdale to put them on a B-36. Right. So I guess I don't know what it means, but it's interesting that NATO is sort of leading with that. I mean, I think Putin has obviously got their attention.
Well, and to add to that, so in a tit for tat fashion, the Russians have already responded to this. There was an article out by Reuters that the Kremlin calls NATO chief's nuclear weapons remark an escalation of tension. So here they're calling the idea that the Western alliance is in talks of deploying more weapons as being an escalation. You know, Russia did not view, at least purposefully, that their deployment of weapons to Belarus as being an escalation, although I've argued in a previous podcast that it was exactly that. It was exactly a message of escalation without escalating, right? And so
we don't know that the weapons actually went there. They just talked about that as well.
Well, we think so. I think there's been some review, but you know, anytime you threaten to change the status quo, you really can you run the risk, right, of escalating, at least through perception. And
we could do a week on declaratory policy,
sure.
And how it seems like a dry and esoteric subject. But it is incredibly important. And the part that I've always been most concerned about is, does our declaratory policy match our political philosophy, match what we're doing with our forces? All right.
Right.
So, you know, if you want to drive some of the nuclear reductionist crowd crazy, you could point out the fact that at certain levels, lower levels that they would like to get to, you have to change your declaratory policy from being counter value to counter, or from counter force to counter value.
Right.
So, you know, at some low level, you stop trying to attack the other, you know, for the non-nuke geek here, you know. When you get down to where you only have a few bombs, the only credible strategy is to hold cities hostage, to target civilian population centers. And that's an ignored topic when people start talking about, you know, about some of these things. But along that line, Putin spelled out that London, Berlin, and Washington were on the target list if, you know, he started suffering conventional loss, you know, unacceptable conventional losses in Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he named cities.
Well, that's pretty escalatory. It gets right up to Khrushchev's blue pencil incident. But let's let me carry through here on this idea. So Putin has repeatedly warned that Moscow could use nuclear weapons to defend itself in extreme circumstances. And it accuses European allies of pushing the world to the brink of nuclear confrontation by giving Ukraine billions of dollars worth of weapons, some of which are being used in Russian territory. Now, while we're not giving them nuclear weapons for sure, it's interesting, Kirk, that as the NATO allies are gaining those ubiquitous F-35s and applying a new sort of stealthy attitude to the capability of delivering the B-61 capability, the F-16s that are being freed up are now being, in some cases, transferred to the Ukrainians to sort of continue this war. And, of course, it's been an interesting thing because what do Russians think when the F-16s from a country that is a nuclear partner in the NATO effort is now showing up with F-16s into Ukraine? It's easy for them to draw a conclusion, whether it be real or propagandic, to say we are giving Ukraine nuclear armed, nuclear capable F-16s. So it becomes this war of messaging, right? So it's always a challenge. And part of this article carries on to the third one that I kind of wanted to bring up here. Well, I'm sorry, it's sort of an addendum to this one, which is that this was back in April, but they're still talking about it in this piece, Stoltenberg is encouraging NATO to begin to sort of take hold of its own effort to fund weapons to Ukraine, to support Ukraine. And the article in the the Telegraph, the London Telegraph. Is that
you made me subscribe to it in order to be able to read the article.
Oh my gosh. I hope you get your money back.
Cost me $1 a month, so I think we're okay.
to Trump proof, quote unquote, Western support to the war torn nation. That is the quote from the article. And that Stoltenberg, who's been a big ally, I think, in this effort to get the NATO allies to contribute to their 2% and beyond, has privately told member states that they need to, quote, shield it and aid Ukraine against the winds of political change, unquote, a very European way of stating the tacit admission that American support is not always guaranteed. You know, there's this straw man that is being built in NATO politics that, you know, if election occurs, that somehow U.S. is going to abandon NATO and abandon Europe. And I just don't believe that that's in the national interest of America, regardless of who's president. And, you know, so
I think Chris has said something, you know, with regard to Trump about understanding when to take him literally.
Right.
And when to take him seriously.
Right.
I think our politics is, you know, has gotten out of hand. It's gone back to where it was pre 1930, you know, the days of yellow journalism. Anyways, beyond that editorial comment, you know, Trump's argument was never about leaving NATO. Trump's argument was that they got to stop free riding.
Right. Which was an Obama term.
Right.
And is also been enforced, or I should say an Obama-Biden term, and is now a Biden term as well.
And Trump was successful in at least getting them to pledge it. But right. Then as soon as he was out of office, they walked back the pledge until Putin made them feel threatened. And now all of a sudden what they're you know, it's the old guns or butter argument. What we've been doing for years have been subsidizing European social programs by underwriting their defense so that they can spend their fungible monies on social programs rather than making their contribution to NATO. And then you can take it one step further and say, is GDP really the right measure? because European GDP growth has certainly lagged the United States. So even when, you know, you put aside the fact that we do more than the 2%, our GDP is growing faster, so we do more on an inflation-adjusted basis. Only, what is it, three other NATO countries were making their 2%?
And well, now it's two-thirds.
And now you finally have got the Europeans saying what Obama, Trump, Biden, Bush had said previously, which is, you know, you guys have got to toe your line too.
That's right.
You have to contribute. So I mean, I think it's refreshing. I think it's, it's a little ironic that they're pointing at Trump, who was, you know, beating them up for not making their 2%, and who they listened to and took seriously. And thinking that when he comes back in, all of a sudden he's going to be less committed to NATO. I mean, I've always read that as he's always said, you know, I read it as, you know, his incendiary comments about, well, if they're not paying their 2%, go ahead and attack them, Vladimir. You know, a lot of people read that as throwing some allies under the bus. I read that sort of as, well, you know, maybe if you're not willing to pay your dues to the club, you know, if you're not willing to pay your dues to Mar-a-Lago, you don't get to eat at the buffet. you know, so
well, to solve that, to address this, the Baltic countries have even proposed adding a 0.25% of GDP to aid Kyiv. So I think that that is interesting. If they come around with another hat for another a percentage of your GDP just to support the Ukraine war, it'll be very interesting to see how the NATO allies react.
It's good to see Europe wake up.
I think so. And I think but NATO understands that as they do this, it raises the their stature in the eyes of Putin, right? And who already sees NATO as his strategic adversary. So let's talk about moving on here to the third item here is that Putin just came out here on the 14th ish of June and offered a peace deal. And offered the conditions of which he is prepared to begin negotiating for peace, I guess, tomorrow, if these things happen, you know, as soon as these things happen. And so reported out there in the world is that.
So can I synopsize the peace deal?
Sure.
Putin said, okay, I win. I'll let you go home.
Well, that's a very broad 50,000 foot summary. Let's do a 25,000 foot summary, and that is so. What's interesting is that the articles all say that he's got two key conditions, but he's really got four. So we're not even getting this straight in the way it's reporting. So the two key conditions are that a complete withdrawal of Ukrainian troops from the territories of the Donetsk, Luhansk, Zaporizhia, and Kherson regions. Now, these are regions that Russia has annexed and claimed to be part of Russia. The problem is that part of those annexed territories are occupied by Ukrainian troops, which is really Ukrainian territory. You get the confusion.
Again,
right? So
1939 all over again.
Exactly. So he's asking the Ukrainians to do what he can't do, which is get the Ukrainians out of the territory that he annexed. So that's key condition number one. The second key condition is, of course, Ukraine's abandonment of any effort to join NATO. And so those are the two key components. But there are two more that are out there that we also have to remember. And that is, he also says that the Ukraine must remain a neutral, non-aligned, and non-nuclear status that is demilitarized and, of course, Kirk, denazified. And then the fourth one is that the proposal includes a cancellation of all Western sanctions on Russia. So even then, all the Western nations are going to have to sign off and be willing to cancel their sanctions. And I'm really surprised because Putin's done.
He's demanding unconditional surrender of the Ukrainians and NATO.
That's right. That's right. And so this is why this war is not going to end, because, of course, President Zelensky's reply is, you need to leave all of Ukraine as the borders were previous to 2014, which would include Crimea. You're right. And what I don't hear, maybe it's out there, but it's not making, the main banners or the front pages of the newspapers, or so to speak. But, I should say this. Zelensky always has a chance in any negotiation. You always have a chance to counter, right? When somebody bought your house, Kirk, you had a chance to, or made an offer. They had a chance to, you had a chance to counter that offer.
I took the money and ran, actually.
But you took the money and you said, I'll take it. But in any case, so what Zelensky ought to be thinking about is, well, what about the counter? Like, how much restitution are you going to pay to rebuild what you destroyed? Repatriation of all of the Ukrainian children that have been removed and taken away, if you will. What about some sort of defense signed, some pledge that will ensure that you're not going to do this invasion all over again? It would be meaningful in any way. But you normally don't walk away without all of that. And what's interesting
was the fifth condition that they signed this at Versailles.
No, probably in Crimea. It's interesting. They complain about all the weapon systems that we're getting. I saw another article here recently that said of the 31 M1 Abrams tanks that the United States has given them, 26 of them are now been pulled off the front line. I don't know if that means the other five have been destroyed or not, because they're useless because of the first person drones, the first person view drones. They are destroying everything. It has changed the character of war on the battlefield, and it has really, really affected the ability of any armored vehicle to get anywhere without being caught and destroyed in the open.
Have you seen the article on there was a recent article or snippet on the Russian turtle tanks?
I saw some of that. Yes.
Yeah. That they basically the defenses they put on the tank to protect it from a $50 drone.
Yes. It's incredible.
Has so limited situational awareness of the tank crews that that Ukrainian infantry basically walked up, knocked on the hatch, and said, "You're our prisoner."
Yes. That's pretty funny. So this again proves that in war, offense is always cheaper than defense. Even though defense and Clausewitzian thought is the more desirable position, but it's sometimes more expensive in that regard. Piggybacking on this, there was a big conclave in Switzerland with nearly 100 nations, most of them Western. They all kind of came together for this Ukrainian peace initiative, where they 80 of them or so signed a pledge of territorial integrity. And what's interesting is the numbers that did not sign. Those that did not sign: India, Mexico, Saudi Arabia, South Africa, Thailand, and the UAE. Not quite sure why they wouldn't sign. I'm sure there were obviously other states as well, I guess, but those are the ones mentioned in the article. Whether or not it is that they don't want to piss off the Russians, who knows? But they are on the wrong side of history, I think.
Well, I mean, the Saudis and the UAE need nuclear weapons to deter the Iranians. I mean, they're not worried about deterring the Israelis. If they were worried about deterring the Israelis,
that's right.
They would have sought a nuclear weapon shortly after everybody came to believe that the Israelis had a nuclear weapon. There's a lot of granularity to understand in that region. The relationship between the Pakistanis and the Iranians, and then you throw in the Indians, that's very, that's very complicated. The Saudi, and the UAE, they still remember Saddam, and they remember Saddam's war with Iran. And they also read the Quran and understand that the Shia, the only thing better than a dead Jew or a dead Christian is a dead Sunni. There's a lot of intricacies in that region why people have joked for years, right after I solve world hunger, I'm going to solve peace in the Middle East.
Right. As we wrap this up, the G7 met in early part of June in Italy, and something came out of this that was very interesting. There was a communique that the G7 leaders all sent out, and they talked about Ukraine. And something they noted was that the damages now exceed $486 billion, according to the World Bank. I think I've reported that on a previous podcast, but that they say that Russian obligations under international law to pay for damage that it is causing are clear, and we are the G7. So we are continuing to consider all possible lawful attitudes by which Russia is made to meet those obligations. So the G7 is apparently going to take it upon themselves to ensure that the Russians comply with an international law that they don't seem to respect anymore anyway. So that will be very interesting. They note here that any use of nuclear weapons by Russia in context of the war and aggression against Ukraine would be inadmissible. So I looked it up. Well, what does inadmissible mean in this context? It means not tolerated, but that's all it says. So this is a kind of an interesting, empty sort of condemnation of something that hasn't happened yet. And if it's a warning, that's pretty soft.
I think part of it is there were some other articles. There are some other things happening. There's some other proposal. I mean, part of the article you talked about previously about NATO stepping up and the 0.25% GDP. There was also some talk about taking monies that have been seized or frozen that are Russian funds and using the interest on those monies in the bank and other income streams that are captive now that belong to Russia and giving those to the Ukraine.
You've lined me up right for the last thing that I wanted to mention was that the G7 notes that there are $50 billion of basically its interest. What they call leveraging the extraordinary revenues of immobilized Russian sovereign assets, sending an unmistakable signal to President Putin. You know what would send an unmistakable signal to President Putin is to actually give that $322 billion in assets to the Ukrainians. But you see, the G7's willing to leverage loans against the interest, but not the principal, because in the end, the G7 is hedging that the Russians are going to survive this, and they want to make sure they get their money back.
Well, there's part of that too, but there are also other, the world of international finance is pretty complicated too. I think the interest is just something that's easier to go after.
Sure,
it's not actually the Russian money; it's the money that they would be getting. And, it's sort of like, seizing the drug dealer's boat type of thing. So I think it's probably has a lot to do with what's easiest to do, both legally and the mechanics of it. But it's very interesting. I mean, it's a way short of a total victory of imposing reparations and sanctions on a country that's waged illegal war. And in the past, that's taken something like the Versailles Treaty in order to be able to accomplish that. You normally have to defeat your enemy totally in order to be able to impose those sorts of things. But the world has changed a little bit.
All right. Well, I appreciate that nuanced answer. My retort to that is that they're not doing it because they don't want to do it. And that's really the only reason, because anything is possible if you're in the G7. Well, look, we are not going to get to the fourth article. We have run out of time because as Adam
says, surprise, you and I talking too much?
I know. There you go. We want to keep our commuters so that they basically get us from door to door anywhere in the country. So we do appreciate all that.
Encourage them to, you know, encourage them to read that article, maybe link it.
Oh, sure.
So,
well, I think there's lots out there. I think the idea that there is a number of lots of news things. We're just in the first half of June, and we just covered three. We had a fourth one, which was the Russian ships in Cuba. And this is just the half of the month of June. So, Kirk, there's a lot of stuff going on, and this is just such a small subject of all the things going on. It is a complicated world out there.
We didn't talk China. We didn't talk AUKUS.
Any of that.
We didn't talk Northeast Asia. So,
So there's lots going on. And so if you're out there, you're riding around and whatnot, you know, I'd encourage you to stay in touch. Please, connect with us on, we're on X. Our handle is @ThinkDeterrence. We're also on Getter, also @ThinkDeterrence, Truth Social @ThinkDeterrence. You can also find us on LinkedIn, at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. Hit us on our website at thinkdeterrence.com and check out some of our articles on globalsecurityreview.com. I think all of these things are free to you. Also, check out our other podcast, The Nuclear Knowledge. We have our friends down in Australia and Chris doing the space strategy report. So there's lots going on here at NIDS. Very excited to have our listeners engaged and involved. And of course, we can't do it without you and your donations and your love and support. So like us, click us, support us, read us, and most importantly, listen to us wherever we can. And
Curtis,
can I
make one additional pitch that
sure.
you missed there as one of the associate editors of GSR?
Yes.
If you found this interesting, if this got you thinking about something, if you've got a view on it that you want to share, connect some of the dots, tell Curtis and I that we were totally full of it. Hey, 800 to 1,000 words. We're always looking for great content at GSR. If you're a budding nuclear geek, you know, send us your opinion, put it in an article, and we'd love to see you become part of the conversation.
Very good. All right, folks, enjoy your rest of your week. And as always, we want you to remember to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to The NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501(c)(3) organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.